should go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust? Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for like the episode of like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants like team up and they overpower the hosts and they share the money.
Bottom up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
We're not doing this in the studio this time because of technical issues caused by being poor. So, like everyone in poverty, it's a matter of resources and not having them, and not whether or not we have the drive or the tenacity to overcome them, because at the end of the day, we need better software. So with me, though, to kind of cover the actions that we were part of a week or so ago in Charlottesville is...
Matt Drescher.
Matt Drescher. Thank you. And I'm your host, Dan Plant, with Three Left Show. So just why don't you just go over your general thoughts about Charlottesville? Let's keep this...
So the thing that really stood out to me that... Because this was my first action working with Antifa. The thing that really stood out to me going into that, going into the town the first morning for the Heather Heyer Memorial was the reaction that we were getting from the local people. Based on like my opinion of Antifa and the way a lot of what you'd call, you know, your regular folks look at them, I wasn't expecting people to be friendly with us. But not only were people being friendly with us, people were generally thanking us for being there, and I thought that was kind of a remarkable thing. It was almost a little surreal, that and having photographers just following you around, taking thousands of pictures. But it was really interesting. I spoke with one of the fellow people in the block, and they were a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. And a thing that they told me was that when they came back, and people would say, thank you for your service, it felt hollow. It didn't really have meaning to them. Some they'd actually resent it. But in this situation, when people were thanking him for being there, he felt that it was a lot more sincere and that he was actually helping the people that were there, whereas when he was in Iraq and Afghanistan, he was generally just helping whichever company was dumping money into a project in that area at the time.
So to clarify, by the block, you meant the black block.
We were black block, in, yes.
Or active. That brings to mind there's the bubble of semi-politically active, or at least they follow politics like sports. So they're very loud on social media, and the Beltway Press is kind of part of that as well. They're very loud, and they kind of project that what public opinion is, even though they are not representative of it at all. Which is interesting, because when it comes to a question that I had about, like, do we care about public opinion? Let's say we upset people with the tactics that us extreme lefties use, or even our general opinions. Like, do we care what they, you know, we have a mission, we're going to accomplish it with as few casualties or harm as possible. And do we care about public opinion? If we're hated for punching Nazis, let them hate us. We welcome it because they're not helping. But then, of course, it's kind of almost a unnecessary concern, almost a self-concerned kind of troll, that, no, people are generally open. There are people who are vocal about, like, their disdain, or maybe some people are unsure. They just haven't heard the arguments we have to make. And they've only heard the argument for the status quo, and that order is more important than peace. And we're disrupting order by by actually being on the offense.
It's almost reminiscent of the anti-war movement. As the anti-war movement started in the early 60s for Vietnam, you had the majority of your people that participated in demonstrations were, they were your fringe people, your counterculture. They weren't your everyday citizens. They weren't your soccer moms, like things like that. And as the war went on and popular opinion started to turn against the war, when it wasn't just poor kids being drafted, when it was the middle class kids, when people were getting pulled out of college, as it started to affect more people or a bigger chunk of society, that was when you started to see a wide range of people begin to participate. And I think something similar to that right now is happening with the Antifa movement. I think a year ago, you really did not have as many people from what you would call the, I guess, the middle class, people that were professionals. And when we were down there, there were a lot of people there that that was their first time, that was their first action. And they were, you know, they were teachers, they were mechanics, they were people that had professional careers. Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. A big part of the action to me was actually just being a part of a disciplined group of activists. It didn't matter what we were doing, the fact that we were actually kind of together in it, that when we were out marching, even if it was just a like a standard kind of political march, that we were doing it, we were tight, we would always keep telling ourselves, we got to keep it tight, stay together, for the defensive reasons of being, you know, fighters, but also just, I think it's always something that I wanted to have in other rallies, just to have that militancy, the need for militancy. Militancy not as meaning the ability to do harm to others as being like the goal, but just that you want to be organized, you want to do it as with comrades, with people you know, they have your back, you don't need to know them that long, you just share that mission. And that's what it felt like there, especially with that safe house we were in, where we had communal sleeping, communal eating, and it's so cathartic on so many levels. That spiritual cleanse that others will talk about when they go to their Buddhist retreat for the weekend. Well, we did that, but it was a little step up, I feel. And to go in the middle of the night, and there's still places, like people are just sleeping where they feel comfortable, and there's still a couch open, because I think maybe someone was thinking, oh, there's going to be more people coming in the middle of the night, they're going to want the couch, they're going to need it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was in the cards, but we didn't talk about who was going to sleep where. There was no fight over it. Didn't even need a meeting over it.
Nope.
It was just, there were also a lot of places to sleep, so there was no scarcity there. And same goes for the food. So it's all a matter of having enough, working hard to make sure that there is, or that there isn't that scarcity, and then people can actually cooperate.
And there was a nice regimentation when it came to doing the dishes, prepping the meals, just getting things ready. The trainings that we had before the actions on Saturday, mm-hmm. teaching about DRS.
It was more a teach-in than a training.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, teach-ins are basically like a mini lecture, going through things. And then a training would be like if we actually went out into that yard and started pulling on each other to practice.
Yeah.
That's something that, you know, I was kind of thinking about I needed, because I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it if I don't have at least a little bit of muscle memory of such a thing. Just like how when I work out, I do a little kickboxing, so I at least have practiced throwing a punch, even if it's just always air, and it's just to tone up my muscles. And people say I look better for it. Oh, you know, and speaking of that... I'm going to read a poem written by Falco, codename from the Nashville Antifa. So she wrote this poem that was kind of expressive of the time there with this group of about 30. So I'm going to read it out. This house is made of fire and ice. This house is made of stone. This house contains the love of my life and souls no one can own. This house is home to hearts ablaze, the warriors of this realm. This house is now the vessel for each master at the helm. This house is home to sick and well, in body and in mind. Your measure is more than your work, and it cannot be defined. This house is for the genderless, the straight, the bi, the queer, the ebbies, trans, the femmes, the masks, and all are welcome here. This house is home to sharps and rash, Antifa and Black Cross, to food not bombs and all our kin who seek to fill the loss. This house is full of anarchists, diverse as they can be. Our doctors, cooks, and medics, plus our brawlers and small beans. This house is home to brown and black, indigenous folk, and more. This house has room for all who need safe harbor at its shore. This house has former prisoners, most precious souls of all. For no one knows the struggle like the captive of those walls. This house is filled with music. This house is filled with art. It's stretched across the country and connected at the heart. These walls create a concrete space that's more than wood and steel. It's made of solidarity that's tangible and real. This house may seem so short for us, a fleeting day or two. But like antimatter, we must try to create it all anew. This house is built by you and me, a sacred place to come. We carry it within our souls and back to where we're from. So when you leave the sacred place, do not despair, my dear. We are not far. You're not alone. Your family lives right here. Did you want to? Do you have anything to say about the actions of that Saturday? Not only so, yeah, you mentioned.
So we had there were two actions on Saturday. We had the first one was going into where Heather Heyer was killed. And several others injured, and doing a brief memorial there. And then the second action was on the campus of UVA, where a student group invited us on to, for our presence to be there mm-hmm. to protect them from potential fascists showing up, and also in addition, protect them from the police that because the school did not. The school did not sanction the speech that they were having because they would not let local politicians go up and, co-opt the thing. And the students were very upset with the school over still pretty much bankrupting people that were hurt in that in the murder last year mm-hmm. At the hospital, at the UVA hospital. And there's apparently money missing from one of the charities that they hosted that mm-hmm. the victims never saw. That the school did.
I see. I wasn't aware of those particular details. I know the details I'll add to it were that they set up a cage around the rotunda. This is the rotunda that Jefferson designed at the University of Virginia. Basically, they were only going to allow those with student IDs in. They were only going to allow people approved, and of course they had set up outside metal detectors and a fence around the whole thing. So it was a big cage, and we and the radical students for their part weren't going to participate in that. They weren't even going to have it inside the building in the first place, but to have it outside within a fenced area with all this police, of course, is you can call that free speech. I don't. It's all very restrictive, obviously. So, and I was impressed at the radical nature of a majority of those that came to this rally that was in the evening that we were invited to, and then we were there, and there were some people who were kind of uneasy about us there. There was always kind of people on the fence, or rather they're just cautious because they don't know what to expect.
Then there were also people lending us material support. We were given water by people.
Mm-hmm.
There were students and alumni that were alerting us to people that they believed to be fascist mm-hmm. because another one of the components that the students were upset about was the school would not ban known white supremacists from campus
right.
that were alumni.
Another grievance to add to the problem.
Yes, yeah. So there plenty were people identifying them.
And so what occurred was we, as you do when you are not a sanctioned state-sanctioned protest, you have to keep moving or else you're declared illegal and then the cops try to kennel you for mass arrest or they at least attempt to or will use force to disperse the gathering since it is not legal. So much for that First Amendment side of it. So you keep moving. So it's basically avoid being dispersed. So you can stay together and can move from place to place. You can even plan it out. And so we stopped at one place, and then the Black Lives Matter folks were giving, and the undocumented students were giving some speeches, very Black Power-y, very cool. And that was when this battalion of riot cops were kind of coming in from a side street on the other side of this park, and We were ready to throw down and form a line and protect the students, not let cops touch them at all. But we were just kind of more accessory to it because half of the crowd rushed to block the riot cops.
Yeah.
And were basically a much more effective wall than we could ever be because they were four deep. We were one deep because we were only 30 or so. And they were numbering in many dozens. And so eventually the riot cops couldn't move forward. They were in fact blocked in, and or they could have went around, but they chose not to, because it would have been much more chaotic for them. And that was encouraging. I like that a lot.
Yeah,
because that's something you don't see up here.
But then you also with the riot cops, we ended up just going the opposite direction of them, and the people that were blocking that way were bike cops. And once we started moving at those guys, they never really let us get within a block of them. They just kept moving down from us. Mm-hmm. So pretty much we just went unopposed to the next action that the students had planned.
Yeah, which was interesting because first it was the only time we kind of had some conflict where it's an amphitheater, which is downhill from where we were coming in. And we could spot, you know, police on other exits. So it's like, oh, we don't want to get trapped here. It's like a bowl. This looks bad, but you know, we were kept on mission, which is protect the students, and that means if they're going in that bowl, we're going in that bowl with them. But it was interesting that the speeches planned were actually kind of sing-alongs, and there was a good amount of opposition of this to the crowd. So I guess there wasn't full agreement on the itinerary. But it was it's always more fun or interesting to me that, you know, I don't go as many protests because they're just so samey and kind of fluffy, I guess.
Yeah.
They're not about expressing power and strength, but or strength through sing-alongs. And against police state and the organized money, I don't feel very strong when I'm in those events.
No.
So this is a similar where we kept ourselves shut being the outsiders, a mouth shut, but it was the other radical students that were actually trying to start some new chance and get us moving again. And they marched all the way back to the downtown area, I believe.
Yeah, we were told the people that invited us there, they told us after that sing-along thing in the bowl that we should leave because they're leaving. So we kind of took that as the end of our invitation, and we also left. The other group of students, the main mass of them, they continued down to where we were in the morning, down mm-hmm. where Heather was killed. And there apparently was some violence between police and students.
A policeman was jumping someone, trying to do an arrest, and then he was dogpiled, and the arrest was prevented.
Nice.
So that was pretty. That's pretty cool. Oops, sorry for the jostling there. Try not to tap my foot at all. The perks of recording in one's bedroom. But hey, if it were for Citizen Radio and some other podcasts that I loved and radicalized me, next was the. Or we move on to DC and just the events there. We weren't there because we had to go back early. Won't expand on that, but it was pretty much a full victory for Antifa.
Had like 20 fascists show up, and they dipped out pretty early.
Which brings up, so, and we covered this in a previous episode, the ways that we're winning, the ways that the alt-right are admitting defeat, or at least the ones that are full neo-Nazis. Now, a troubling development, or at least something mentioned by Doug Lane of Zero Books, is that the Proud Boys in the West Coast are kind of more Italian-style fascism. And so they're not wearing the swastikas and so on, and they can still, they're still, like, their events are still kind of fun for them. So there's still, like, 100 or so showing up.
Yeah.
And that's enough for a full, and maybe it's just Portland cops are just meaner and more white supremacists, but they are getting the full...
Now, Portland is looking like the front lines in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although that being said...
Seattle.
Seattle. But in the near future, there are two big things coming up. You have in Madison, Indiana, a large KKK rally coming up at the, I believe that's in the, that's actually this weekend or next weekend. And then you have, I believe it's Labor Day weekend. No, the last weekend in September, excuse me, is Kent State. There's going to be a large.
Oh, yes. 3%. Open carry.
Yeah, it's going to be both sides pretty strapped walking around Kent State, which need not explain the historical significance of that.
Or if you're a young viewer from Gen R, it's where a police massacre occurred of students during an anti-war protest.
It was a National Guard, yeah.
National Guard. And, so it was part Army, yes.
And one of the people actually killed was not even part of the protest. He was a he was an ROTC cadet that was just walking through the parking lot and got hit with a stray bullet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then his family received death threats from the far right because they associated him with a war protester.
Yeah. Not that anyone should get death threats of any kind, just threaten people's job or economic security, which, of course, the state and the right does to almost everyone in this country every day, whether or not even if you're on their side. You know, if you're a conservative person in a southern state, your economic security is very much not there for the longest time, and doesn't matter how much you vote for them, they don't seem to care.
No.
They don't seem to provide that security that whiteness is supposed to confer. Let's see. So next was, I'm just moving down my list of points here, that, So part of this work, Antifa or otherwise, more militant work, depends on all the different layers of, what was it? The preparation that we kind of had, that we were able to kind of do this work, or even if we were just kind of being regular marchers, but just a little bit more scarier, I guess. But we were take those risks because we knew that we had jail support, we knew that we had legal defense, we had all of these layers of contingencies.
Yeah.
If something went wrong, we had backup plans.
You're not on your own.
And it's and that's the difference between. I'm willing to take some small risks, even or small to moderate risks, and saying, as anyone would, I don't want to be arrested. I don't want to get into an actual fight today. I don't want to actually hurt anybody. And saying, I will never hurt anyone. I cannot be arrested. I cannot take any risk. Because there's a kind of catastrophic mindset of if one thing goes wrong, it's going to avalanche and ruin your life and you'll starve and be homeless for the rest of your life. Because it goes from you're charged with a misdemeanor and you're fired and then you'll never work again. And it's the kind of, plague amongst us Americans, I think, whether you're incel, trans, any kind of marginalized group, and everyone's kind of marginalized from the capitalist class, so I think everyone can kind of count to some extent. We all kind of have that catastrophic, if one thing goes wrong, it's all over, so I can't take any risks, I must only be out for myself, which is the ultimate definition to me of pragmatism, and if everyone uses it in front of me, I'm usually like, oh, okay, you're just caring about yourself. And I'm not that respectful of that. How do you feel?
Well, I definitely agree with you there that it made me feel a lot more emboldened to know that I had that backup. And just even to see that when one of the cars on the way back to the safe house got pulled over and these people were ready to mobilize, they had their lawyers getting ready. They were setting a car to where they were pulled over. They were talking on the phone with the mm-hmm. people in the car, yeah. giving them legal advice there, telling mm-hmm. them to record the cops, to get names.
What to not do and so on.
Yeah.
Because you could panic easily in that situation, which we all kind of imagine. I do.
But they were the professionality of these individuals that were there was...
Yeah.
It was really remarkable. I didn't know what to expect going down there, like the kind of people that would be there.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of expecting maybe some like train kids kind of.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of like what
Maybe that's what it was last year, what you're referring to, that it was more the scruffiest of the scruffy.
Yeah.
Doing Antifa work, and thus, you know, they're getting a clock clean sometimes because they aren't that well taken care of.
But they
but some of these were kind of, yeah, as you say.
They're very, very professional. And even the way, you know, people were doing reconnaissance.
The day before.
Or the day before, or even during the action, like the people that are going out and like doing recon, that was...
I didn't see how that was decided.
The person...
But certainly...
How they decided who did it?
Or, I mean, there was... I mean, we were basically joining other actual existing groups, so they have their designated roles between them.
Yes.
So we were just kind of there as their backup, and we could just take their... suggestions and
from talking to the
follow their lead.
From talking to the people that were at the action on Sunday in DC, the pivotal thing there, the game changer, was this tight relationship between Antifa and Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was without a doubt Black Lives Matter that got us out. I say us, but I myself was not there.
But of a police kettle that was in strength, because after the fascist rally fizzled out after a light sprinkle. They went to kind of go to the ICE headquarters to kind of put the fear of God in them there.
Yep.
Do just kind of general protest there. I don't know. But the police were ready for anything, and maybe they were expecting it. I don't know. But
yeah, I mean, they from what I've
probably had some ideas.
From what I ascertained, they got them some. They started the kettle around the Department of Justice building, and the people that we were with split into three different groups, all of which were led by someone locally from Black Lives Matter. Mm. The first group
had some coordination.
I don't know how coordinated it was. I think it was just kind of just worked that way.
Yeah,
another one of those lucky accidents. But the first group, the dude from Black Lives Matter, had a pair of bolt cutters he must have stashed, cut them through a fence, and they dipped out. The other group, they got through a back door and ended up in the kitchen of a restaurant.
Yeah.
And the manager of the restaurant helped them get, you know, helped them through the restaurant and out onto the street. I don't know if that was benevolence, if he was...
Or just, I want you out of here.
Or, yeah, I don't want the cops to come, and then you barricade yourself in here. And then the third group...
Stars of our own movies, though. I mean, that's the excitement of being on the offense, even when you're not really breaking that many... you're not really breaking laws here. You're just kind of being disobeying that civil disobedience.
Yeah.
But with it's also, pretty civil at the end of the day.
Also with the D.C. police, though. Like
you're throwing some oranges, you're throwing some things, but otherwise I wouldn't call it a war in the streets.
Well, there were people that were throwing, apparently, garbage cans, things like that, at the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And challenging cops to fighting. And that third group made it out through a church. The cops pursued them into a church, and they got out through the back.
Right. Sanctuary.
Yeah, I don't know how well that one would have stood up.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I don't think that's a legal defense anymore. It's all private property now, sucka.
Red and black flag.
Portland, especially that. Well, I was reading an article covering the Portland stuff, and it kind of said, like, oh, it seemed that peace had reigned because the police had kept the two groups apart. Like, no, that's order reigning, because this is a political situation that is not sustainable, because you literally have people who want genocide and do violence. If they've got, you know, they don't even need power, they're going to go out and hurt people.
I mean, they've had enough murders on the West Coast just to...
Yeah, exactly. They're all lone wolves, except they're also all the same community as well.
Yep.
They're just not active members, because since, I don't know, the 70s or so, I mean, it's hard to get a group with an active membership anymore, you know? Green Party and others, and socialists too, we're trying to revive that by having dues again and act like unions and have membership that actually contribute, so that when you're a part of something, you are in fact a part of it, even if you're not actively going to all these meetings and stuff and doing every little thing.
Yeah, getting people to pay their Socialist Party dues is like getting blood from a stone. Not too many people are very thrilled about those.
Mm. Well, oh, they're not? Well, I shouldn't ask about what you're doing with the money, or what is...
It goes to National.
Well, that's probably why.
Yeah, you never see it.
With the Green Party, half is kicked back to locals. Yeah. So you do get a share of it. And we know what's happening at the state level with it. It's going to actually hire staff and stuff and keep the lights on. So... of National, who knows? But yeah, especially the National Green Party, that's a bit of trouble too. So keep, you know, but locally you can keep track and go to an annual meeting or so. So we're reaching about a half an hour. There's the pull of insurrectionism that I've kind of been dealing with over the summer. So insurrectionism, for the listeners, is, as I define it, okay, it has a few variants, I suppose, but it's basically kind of a following the conclusion that our elections are rigged, power is money, and power is concentrated, speech is money, most general reform activism is short-lived or futile, as a recent campaign in Seattle for progressive tax to fight homelessness. They worked for 9 months to get a unanimous vote from the city council to pass this progressive tax. It was like a head tax on the largest corporations. Yeah. And in a month's time, the Amazon and all the tech companies, they threatened to leave town. They threatened everyone their jobs, including the city council. They threatened candidacies against them, and they were going to... They already created a multi-million-dollar war chest.
Yep.
And a ballot initiative with petitioning to just repeal that tax. So you work for 9 months, and in 3 months, it basically all falls apart.
Yeah,
because of organized money.
You got people you can throw money at a political problem. And we've seen interest groups doing that forever.
Now, organized money can be beaten in the short term, but I stress the short term, with organized people. But it takes years and years to organize the people, or people in general, for a particular cause, and it needs to, and this can only be happening, this only happens in our lifetimes, for a particular cause. So I'm thinking the anti-fracking movement here in New York, you know, it took years and years to get the critical mass to pressure the governor and the state to actually enforce that memorandum and declare that we're not going to frack. But we're still going to keep frack garbage, so the fight continues, and the state pension fund is still investing in fossil fuels, which is the main issue with our state campaign in Green Party-wise. But that took like 5 years to pretty much get done, to build that critical mass for. But again, usually against something, to block something.
Yep.
Whether it be ending net neutrality, which just by attrition almost, after the third time was the charm and they could finally kill net neutrality or weaken it, which, you know, to the extent that they've succeeded in doing so. Regardless of what Congress is trying to do with their repeal efforts or what have you.
Yeah, net neutrality was like watching someone chop down a tree. You don't know how many swings it's going to take, but you know how many they're going to use.
And as many as it takes.
Yeah.
And they can afford it. So there's a pull to interactionism, which is, at very least, building of autonomous power, kind of as some of those toxic men put it, going your own way. But going your own way from these more civil, legal, or at least legalized ways of doing politics through elections, through activism. But instead going through direct action, like that story you mentioned, and doing mutual aid, which is kind of what I've been interested in doing this year.
Yeah.
It dovetails with Antifa, you know, where we don't want to depend on the state to censor people. We certainly, our institutions have failed to prevent the rise of any fascist movement. So we had to do it ourselves.
I mean, in that, when you look at the rise of fascist movements in the United States, I think a very remarkable thing is when we look at the end of World War II, you had nothing that was done against the American Nazis. Lincoln Rockwell, all those guys, they kept on doing their thing. But the communists, on the other hand, whom were our allies in the war, immediately following the war, become public enemy number one in the second Red Scare. And I find that very remarkable that we were so hospitable to Nazis, given their atrocities just years prior, yet we went at the communists like that.
It was all very like a switch, but also not really, because it was just Jews that they killed. I mean, it took a good 15 years before people like, oh yeah, the Holocaust was bad. It's kind of why.
Yeah, I mean, the Catholic Church wasn't exactly an outspoken critic of it.
Yeah, it's right. It was a long slog to get that recognition. It was a fight in itself to get that recognition. Otherwise, American society has been white supremacist, very racist, and you would have a minority or other ethnic communities like the Jewish community who were more obviously better on that. And thus, they were all part of the civil rights movement, or at least many of them were, and members of the Communist Party. Until it was basically illegal to be a Communist Party member. And that's how they kind of destroyed the socialist movements in America, is the same way we have been fighting the fascists, is threatening people's jobs, livelihoods, and so on. And so it's kind of, we need to make ourselves kind of immune, or at least to have resilience to that kind of pressure by owning our own jobs, by having a work or businesses that are independent of general capitalist system almost. But that is a big ask. Well,
Have you seen the factory in Greece? Have you heard about that?
In the anarchist neighborhood or something else?
So what you had happen was this.
I did see an headline.
Yeah, a factory that was making some kind of they're making some kind of like chemicals for building homes. They went out of business. Mm. The workers surveyed the neighborhood and, like, what do you need?
Mm-hmm.
And they began making soaps there. So now it is a worker-run shop.
Soap factory.
Yeah, that just makes soap for the community. And I, like, it's a huge inspiration. I would love to see, you know, like, something like that happen around here. We got enough, you know, Rust Belt stuff that's all shut down.
Asking the people of our poor neighborhoods what they need and kind of setting up some workshops. Now, then it becomes a challenge of getting the inputs for such a business.
Yep.
You still need to kind of interact with other businesses out there for that. Keep costs down, renovate a building. I kind of wish there was the factories that do exist in our area, like at Fort Edward, that have been closed by GE. They attempted to kind of be self-owners, but they needed the state to provide the financing to do so. And the state, being run by Republicans, didn't want to do that. Or, you know, Democrats who pretend they're progressives when they're not really for workers. Otherwise, they would have maybe acted to finance basically so we could keep the jobs here, because GE wanted to outsource all of their operations to Florida, another non-union states.
Everyone talks about how important creating these jobs, how important creating jobs is, but they only want to do it if there's someone that can get rich off it. Because if you just wanted to make jobs, you can make jobs. FDR made jobs during the Depression.
Yeah. Pay artists.
Yeah. You can make jobs.
Build the broadband, as it were. And keep paying private companies to do it, and it's not profitable for them to do it, so they don't do it.
Yeah. And that's another thing that's very criminal, is we had all this infrastructure that was built, publicly financed, and we just handed it over to these companies.
Right, eventually. Or even right away, I think, yeah. Sometimes. It's a sordid history to dig into it. A lot of small details, but it can build your narrative of that what is wrong with America or our society has always been there. And it's been, and the good spots in the good history is always in the form of resisting it. And we're kind of we're continuers of that. But we kind of want to do more than just resist, right? You know, we want to have our own stuff, our own state almost.
Yeah.
Our own government. And for that, you kind of have to, there's always that kind of narrative. Let's see, the Way Beyond the Pines, the movie kind of has a message of people don't climb out of poverty unless they're stealing from someone.
Yeah.
Whether it be a drug dealer, a bank robber, or a business owner who basically dumps their waste and doesn't take care of it in a responsible way. They're stealing from the public. They're stealing from other people's health, and so on and so on. Bankers steal, obviously, in all sorts of ways. It's just not called that sometimes.
When people steal my labor for their own profit,
of course,
that's just called a job.
The ultimate theft, the ultimate theft of rent, and so on. But I just want to keep that more abstract, or actually more concrete in what could legally actually be called theft.
Yeah.
How do we get our neighborhoods back? How do we get them from banks? You know, you squat, so you break some laws, or at least follow squatter law, which is very weak in America, different than in Europe, where there's a robust squatter movement, where people have taken over these luxury condos that no one was buying, but were built to push poor people out.
Yep.
They move back in, and tall buildings are easier to defend, so they're able to kind of hold on to them. But some laws are actually kind of protective of that, or at least help them out. And some governments will actually negotiate with squatters to sell to them.
Yeah, I can't imagine the U.S. government doing that.
Yeah.
Imagine a SWAT team rolling in.
No, oh man. Well, in Argentina, there was all sorts of stuff like that during their kind of quasi-revolution. And it was all about getting the people in the neighborhood. Numbers matter quite a lot, and that means knowing who your neighbors are, at least at a glance. But also knowing your neighbors is also kind of a step towards finding who is like-minded, and that's probably more important than just making nice with people you might not have anything in common with, and so solidarity may not be possible, or at least unlikely, or it feels really awkward. Do you ever get that?
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Yeah, because I mean, in our lifetimes, liberal society has been powerless to against organized money. I mean, they just take all this ground. So I'm just continuing the case for insurrectionism.
Yeah.
But I waffle between that and my other reformist tendencies, I guess, as I encounter ideas from reformist circles or reforms that are not reformist, that like public banking. If you have public banks, then it's not actual, you don't have that interest. So it's not, you don't have that layer of theft that becomes the first layer of theft, and then everyone else has to steal.
Yep.
Whether it be a small business, your big business, so on and so on, or even nonprofit.
Definitely, they'd make their money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I mean, there's different classes of them.
Yeah.
That's a distinction I should make. Oh, yeah, I was having a conversation on Facebook with a friend of mine. Shout out to Josh and Jack. About imagining if everyone kind of acted on their opinions referring to, like, everyone has opinions about politics. They have opinions about the president. They have opinions on the state of the world. And how often do you see people actually acting on it? And when they do, it's always some form of extremism.
Yeah.
Imagine if moderates actually acted on. Of course, I mean, when they do act on their opinions, it's usually doing nothing or impeding the progress of people trying to do the right thing.
I mean, I think when you have moderates act on their opinions, that's when they file for a permit and they all hang outside.
Wear pink hats.
Yeah, they all hang outside like a government building mm-hmm. on a Saturday mm-hmm. when no one's there.
And have sing-alongs. I write of the delusions of corporations or the rich being neutral, so left and right can battle in the marketplace of ideas. Is it a question of people not having confidence in their own opinions because of bad education, or that ability to not take risks? To, well, if I have an opinion, almost that's a risk, like a thought, a risk of having the wrong thoughts at your job, because so many of our jobs are about not thinking for yourself. Will it be institutions like state jobs where you're actually not allowed to be political in the office?
Yeah.
And obviously there are many bosses who are just keep it out of here.
Yep.
Whatever it is. Bad for business. And I was explaining what hyper-reality was to him. That, you know, America is a big show, and power itself is an image. That's kind of what hyper-reality means. And to subvert that is either create images counter to that or break these images by actually not playing along with the show, by actually acting in a real way. I mean, when we're punching Nazis, we're so shocking because it's so different than the rest of the actual violence that our state does. America, the show. Trump giving, you know, doing what he does. It's also surreal and people can't believe it. Why should they? But when people are in their face about unionizing or challenging progressives or liberals that you should be in a union, why aren't you in a union? Why aren't you starting one? You say you support workers. You're a worker, aren't you? Don't you believe you're a worker? Many of them don't seem to.
No.
And thus the solidarity isn't there. So that's the class consciousness we're trying to bring to the table.
No, I mean, that's definitely something I notice a lot, is that I'll go down to the South and you'll have, you know, I have family down there that, you know, they're broke, but they don't recognize why. They think the reason that they're poor is because of poorer people taking from them. They don't recognize that it's the bloated military budget. They don't recognize it's the massive tax breaks for the wealthy, that that's where their money really goes. They find it so convenient to punch down at minorities or poor people living in cities, because those are the people that can't fight back. They don't want to look up at the rich because they idolize the rich. They all think they're going to be rich someday, whether it be hitting the lottery or pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. They mm-hmm. they honestly believe it. It's
to break that delusion is to, I mean, just speaking personally, it was this kind of realization that we're really not all allowed to be successful. And not just allowed, but I mean, it's not physically possible yep. within capitalism. We can't all be successful. Some of us have to be poor. There has to be some amount of unemployment. I think learning of that, just like there has to be 4% unemployment, we can't have full employment, basically, ever, is like, well, if our system can't do that, I mean, and there's always going to be someone out of work. If someone has to be out of work, I mean, that's not fair. So we all can't be successful. I mean, imagine, what would it look like if everyone was successful? I mean, could everyone be middle class? I want to hear a liberal economist explain how that's possible. And they say it is, but with basically the state providing a guaranteed minimum security.
Yeah, the universal basic income.
Something like that. So if that's the only way we can actually have that. But, I mean, we're basically entering full wealth distribution within capitalism. And so you have to be a democratic socialist at the very least, if yeah. you're going to make any kind of sense.
It's funny, like, you look at, like, the shows from the 50s and 60s predicting what the future is going to be like.
Yeah, okay, and that kind of futurism. And retro futurism.
Yeah, but believing that automation and robots, they're going to take over all of our jobs, and then we just won't have to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
as if everyone isn't paid now for the work that they do. Or yeah. Something. Like, maybe the assumption... I don't know what the fuck... I don't know what was in their heads, but... maybe there was an assumption that everything would be so cheap and available that no one would actually have to work, and you just, it's so accessible that even if you didn't work or have a position anywhere, that you could get all the stuff. But it is, of course, all within the framing that you are still shopping. But I don't think in any of those retrofuturisms you ever see anyone trading money. Maybe in the Jetsons, obviously.
Yeah, I think there was currency in the Jetsons.
Yeah.
But then you look at what the reality, though, of automation has actually yielded, and it's just more competition, more poverty, people fighting for fewer and fewer jobs. Yes. And it's no longer, it was always the, well, if your job can be replaced by a machine, you clearly weren't that smart. That's slowly becoming not the case anymore. You're seeing right now higher skilled factory workers are being lost to automation. Mm-hmm. There is a kid out in... one of the big California schools that wrote a computer program that can litigate parking tickets. You give that kid some time and you're gonna replace lawyers.
My question is, why should one's ability to eat be based on how smart you are?
Why should your ability to eat be limited, be determined by how much work you can do? I mean, not necessarily by intelligence.
Exactly.
But it's...
But I'm trying to make that counterpoint that these guys, this small straw man or real person, as sometimes they are, really do not have any actual kind of human solidarity or, like, humanism at all. Like, it's like, oh, well, if you're not smart enough, then I guess you should just die.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you're an asshole. You're a hole, and... hell you. Then you shouldn't be part of this conversation. This conversation assumes that we actually want a society where everyone can live and live well. And right? If you're not part of that, you think people should be able to fail, and failure means death, because as it is now, that is the case. It isn't you fail and then there's a safety net that stops you from dying. No, even if you have food stamps and you still qualify for that, and but if you're homeless, you're still going to die before 50 because there's all kinds of health problems that are going to affect you.
And I think it's you have people that deep down know that they have not been the success they think they were going to be in their lives. But seeing a homeless person, seeing somebody else having a rough go of it, that validates them. That makes them still believe that, you know what, yeah, I am something. Look at that guy. He doesn't even have a house, yeah. Even though I got a small one. It's they've taken that competition of capitalism, they've just gone to the next step with it. Where if you've lost the game for whatever number of reasons, that makes you a loser and I'm a winner. And I hate to go back to, you know, Donnie, but it's that Trump mentality. But it was around way before him. He's a symptom of the disease. But it's that mentality,
yeah,
that there's winners and losers, and I'm the winner.
So you probably heard this stuff before. So, but it's coming from a place of we're actually out in the streets and kind of trying to put this stuff into practice and feeling some good vibes from it. So I'm going to wrap up now. So you've been listening to Three Left Show, our first kind of mini episode, rather an hour. They're going to be an hour from now on. If it's a mega topic that does last 2 hours, I'll split it in half. So visit our website, 3lefts.news, numeral 3lefts.news. That is all for archived episodes and other info, I suppose. Yes, I put info there. There is the Facebook page, and you can also find this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and hopefully soon Spotify. Gotta wait a little longer for that. I think they're a little more stringent, since if with some ad income, maybe I could actually be paid. But otherwise, if you want to support the show so I don't have to depend on ad revenue, go to Patreon, 3lefts. Just type that in, and we have a Patreon page, and that money will go to the station so we can actually buy some computers that work. Okay? Thank you very much. Thank you, Matt, for being with me.
It was great. Great being